they would try to teach us how to be friends with ourselves. But they don't. They teach us how we have to work with other people. Be sure that we make a good impression on the neighbors and the people around us. You know? We have to show respect to our elders, particularly the priest and the preacher, and the mother-in-law. But they don't tell us how to get along with us, how to become friends with ourselves. Now, in my opinion, sobriety, the definition of sobriety is the ability to live comfortably, peacefully, and joyously with me. This is sobriety. And anything short of it is partial sobriety. When I got here, we didn't think of these things. When I got to the program, all of us thought if we hadn't had a drink today, we were sober. And we talked much about putting the plug in the jug, putting the plug in the jug, putting the plug in the jug. I never had any problem putting the plug in the jug. I was periodic for 10 years. And after every drunk, I put the plug in the jug. Periodics have to get sober. There's no way a periodic can keep them getting sober. Because we're pigs. We drink everything there is that's too thin to chew. And we drink it all. The time when it comes when we can't get it down, we can't get it up, and we can't live, and we can't die. So we have to get sober. So I never had any problem putting the plug in the jug. I quit forever. With and without us, almost. Put the plug in the jug. My problem was not putting the plug in the jug. It was taking the plug out of the jug. Because when my time came, I took the plug out of the jug. And I was off again. So, physical sobriety is absolutely important. To me, it's synonymous with life. I cannot live and drink, and of myself, I can't keep from drinking. So I have to be physically sober, lest I die. So I'm not selling physical sobriety short. It's the foundation under sobriety. But sobriety is physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual. Four parts of the same thing, and it adds up to the ability to live comfortably, peacefully, and joyously with me. This is sobriety. Now, this program is more important to me today than it was 29 years ago. Because 29 years ago, if I could have just died and had it over, it would have been the greatest thing in the world. I was born knowing that suicide wasn't an answer. But it never occurred to me that drinking yourself to death was suicide until I was sober 5 years. So I tried my damnedest to drink myself to death, but I couldn't make it. You can't drink yourself to death if you want to die. The guys that die with alcoholism don't want to die. If we want to drink ourselves to death, we just go nuts and stay nuts, but we can't get over the brink. I want to make this point. One of the great big insurance companies in the country was built by a man whose son got sober and Alcoholics Anonymous. He was an attorney, and he was never going in the insurance business. He was going to stay an attorney. And it was a beautiful empire. And I don't know how much effect I had on him, but I talked with him for a long, long time about getting on in that business and taking over, because his dad was way long in years. And he eventually did. And he was the man that built his empire. And he was pretty old. And he was doing a bit of drinking. And his son talked to him a little about it. And he says, I can drink myself to death if I want to. And his son says, no, you can't. Well, he says, so-and-so did. Mentioning another big man in the insurance business who had drunk himself to death. And the lad says, yes, but he didn't want to. And it hit me like a ton of brick, because that's what I was trying to do. But I couldn't make it. The thing that hastened me in Alcoholics Anonymous after 25 years was that I knew I wasn't going to die. I was going to stay insane. And I'd sit there in that chair of mine thinking about the boys, my boys. When the kids in the block says, where's your dad? And they'd say, he died. And they'd turn and walk off. Because they couldn't tell him I was in Patton. With just enough left to know how to tie my shoes and why I was there. You know? That kind of dreaming drives you nuts. It drives you nuts. So it helped to drive me in here. We can't make it if we try. And it never occurred to me until I was 5 years sober that drinking yourself to death was suicide. But of course it is. Now, how am I going to stay sober? I have to be sober. Sobriety and life are synonymous. How am I going to stay sober? I'm going to so perform that I'm comfortable right here. That's the only way I can stay sober. When I get to feeling a certain way right here, I'll get drunk. Now, I hear many people say that if you've been in Alcoholics Anonymous a while, you have to think to drink. I don't believe it. I don't think you have to do anything but quit doing the things that keep you comfortable right here. And you wake up drunk. Because, you see, you and I know a way to stop that big hurt. And if we allow it to hurt like it used to hurt, we'll be just as drunk as we were in the old days. And we don't have to think about it at all. Just quit doing the things that keep us comfortable right here. Now, I believe with the doctor that alcoholism is a disease. I believe that it's terminal. I believe that it's a disease of twofold nature, an allergy to the body coupled with an obsession of the mind. I accept all this. But I do not believe that that's all there is to the disease of alcoholism. If it was merely mental and physical, a good internist and a good psychiatrist could take me apart and put me back together and I'd tick. But this doesn't very often happen to us. Once in a while, somebody gets sober and stays sober. But it doesn't often happen. So, there must be something else to this deal. living problem, and we must have a living answer. And inasmuch as there has never been a mass recovering program for alcoholics that did not include a basic spiritual rest, then it seems kindergarten to me that the problem behind the problem is a basic spiritual unrest. Now, I say often when I'm about ready to quit talking, the time has to come to in our lives when we come to see that if there be fault, it's mine. If there be fault, it's mine. And I say if there be fault because I don't believe there's fault. I believe that you and I are the victims of a combination of characteristics which came with us that makes it impossible for us to integrate ourselves into the life that we're born into this so-called civilization that we're born into. And I look at myself and a few thousand of you people, and it seems that there are three characteristics that are common to all of us, so common that they're so easy to see. In every one of us, regardless of race, color, creed, religion or the lack of it, education or the lack of it, which side of the tracks we were born on, don't make any difference. Every alcoholic that I've ever known, almost throughout the world, is a perfectionist, an idealist, with the terrific drive for excellence that goes with perfectionism. It is this drive for excellence that brought about the cliche that you've heard ever since you were a little guy. This is the best mechanic we ever had in the shop, but the best lawyer that ever hit this part of the country, but the best stenographer we ever had in the office, but she can't get down till about of a Tuesday or Wednesday. Thanks so much. Terrific drive for excellence. Perfectionism. Now, perfectionism is a beautiful characteristic or attribute when we learn how to live with it. But until we do, it'll kill us. It makes us set goals for ourselves that we cannot attain. And we're forever disappointed in our own performance. And it makes us demand more of those around us than they can put out. And it makes it necessary for us to make them over. Our wives and our kids and the people that work with us and so on. It's a killer until we learn how to live with it. Perfectionism, idealism. And it's very evident in all of us. The second thing is that to a man, we were born with the interior awareness that life should be a good and a big and a beautiful thing. I knew when I was 6 years old that life should be like it is now. My insides proclaimed it. But I looked at it and it was cheap and it was dirty and it was ugly. And that was one of my biggest problems. I couldn't integrate myself in the life around me because I didn't like it. There was a scene, if you remember, in the days of Wine and Roses. It just tears the heart out of me, and I haven't had a drink for 29 years. Every time I think of it, it does me in. This gal had come back to her husband's apartment to try to talk him, her ex-husband's apartment, try to talk him into rejoining her in the drinking world. And he'd gotten into Alcoholics Anonymous. And he was begging her to join him in this new way of life. And she was standing looking out the window, high above New York City. And she finally says to him, I can't. When I look out of this window, sober, it's cheap and it's dirty and it's ugly. And when I look out drunk, it's beautiful. For 25 years, the only way I could stand what I looked at was to be half in the bag. And this is one of my big problems, and yours. And lastly, there are many more, but we'll just use three. And this is the most incongruous thing you'll ever hear come out of the mouth of an alky. And I caution you not to speak of this to your psychiatrist. We are a highly sensitive people. Now, isn't that something? When Norway lay in the gutter, and the pig got up and slowly walked away. We're a highly sensitive people. That's the reason that the psychiatric world, from one end of the world to the next, has labeled us as being emotionally immature. Every one of them. We're emotionally immature. I don't believe it. I think that we have several times the capacity for feeling that the psychiatrist has. If a psychiatrist came in and found me lying there on the floor in front of my big window, so drunk I couldn't even get up, crying my eyes out over a beautiful sunset, emotional immaturity. He don't know it's so damn pretty I can't stand it. Now again, I haven't had a drink for 29 years. But a year ago, I was down on the knobs above Louisville, Kentucky, along the Ohio River. And it was in October, and the leaves had turned. And it's the most beautiful sight on the face of the earth. All those beautiful colors. And miles of it. It's so beautiful. I sat there all alone in my car and bawled my eyes out. It's pretty, couldn't stand it. We're not emotionally immature. We are highly sensitive people. Now, as I've told many of you, I've been in prisons practically all over the world. Mostly as a guest. I could leave after a while. And amongst them is Folsom. Now, Folsom is for habitual criminals. You can't get into Folsom for murder if it's first time. You have to be a habitual criminal to get into Folsom. They tell me up there that the swallows that build up there in those rocks used to build in Capistrano. But they're four-time losers. So they build up there in the stone wall around that place now. I stood there and talked to twice this many people or three times this many people and watched them cry right along with me. And the tears bouncing off their bellies, and they make no attempt to hide it. And it isn't because they're emotionally immature. It's because of the identity. They feel right here exactly like I do. And they cry with me and they laugh with me. And it isn't because they're emotionally immature. Now, I'm convinced that people like us, when we get here, have all the characteristics for alcoholism except alcohol. All we have to do is add a little alcohol and we're off. Very few things can happen to us. From the time we're born, we're either going to be priests, preachers, or nuns, or hopheads or alcoholics. Because we cannot integrate ourselves into the life around us. And it's not because we don't want to, because we do. We want so much to be a part of. And we're forever apart from. And so, this is our problem, a basic spiritual unrest. Unfortunately, the teachers don't know the answers. I bury a few people. I think I told you I had two this week. Monday and Tuesday, I had funerals. A few months ago, I was asked to give a little eulogy for a 16-year-old girl who had taken an overdose. Oh, cocaine. That's the end thing down in my country now, cocaine. And she died. And I got out there to the place. The cemetery, because there was no chapel deal. It was just a graveside service. And that whole hill was covered with kids. I don't know how many, just a whole passel of kids, teenagers, on that hill. And I said to myself, this can't be just a regular deal. I've got to talk with these kids. And I talked first for a little bit with their parents. And there's a few older people that were there. And I told them that I didn't believe in death and why and so forth and so on. And then I started talking to kids. And I told them I had great empathy for them. Because I too had been born into a society that I couldn't swallow. I couldn't integrate myself into. And I had to find a way to be comfortable because I was not comfortable in society in which I had to move. And when I was 19, I found a way to get comfortable in that society. And for the next 15 years, I used this chemical for an answer. And it was an answer for the first 15 years. But after 15 years, my answer turned on me and became a problem. And in the next 10 years, it made it necessary for me to find the right answer. And I did. And then I told these kids that if they could just come to see that there was an answer that stayed with us. He says, when you're behind the acid, you got all the answers. But when the acid's gone, you ain't got none. The answer's gone too, you see. But there is an answer that stays with you. And it's so much better than any chemical that you can put in your body, that you can sing about your business, the business of living. And you don't have to repeat a dosage of chemicals. And if you just decide that you want to find this answer and make an effort, you can find it. And there are many people that will help you. And if you do this, maybe this life will be, this death will be justified. My mother called me the early part of the week. First time since I had been there. And she said there was quite a movement amongst the teachers and amongst the students to find an answer to replace this stuff. And she told me about some guy that's throwing his house open to kids there in Laguna Beach. And they wanted me to come down there last Friday, but I had to do something else, and I couldn't go. Friday a week. But isn't that beautiful that they might now be looking for something that might take the place of this chemical deal? And I want to close with this little story. Before Alcoholics Anonymous was born, there was a chap by the name of Roland. Roland was an alky. And Roland was doctoring with Dr. Carl Jung, who might possibly be the greatest psychological mind that the world has produced so far. If I was learned, that would be a good opinion, but I'm not. But to me, he was tops. He was the same vintage as Freud and Adler and Jung. But it seems that Jung had a personal answer. He had a living answer, and maybe the others didn't. And Roland was doctoring with him. And every time he came back to him, he was worse. And he finally came back to him, Dr. Jung. And the doctor told him, he says, medical science has done everything in its power for you, and it can do no more. Psychiatry has done everything in its power for you, and it can do no more. And now it's my duty to tell you that your only hope is to find a spiritual experience that might save you. It's your only chance. Now, this was some little time before Alcoholics Anonymous was born. And eventually, Abby called on Bill. And eventually, Bill heard the pronouncement that we've talked about already. He might have six more months to live, and then his wife would have to either lock him up or bury him. And he called out, God, if there be a God, reveal yourself to me now. And something happened. And he got sober. And he shared this thing pretty well until he died.
Never had thinking.
Now, after he and Dr. Bob and some of the rest of them had worked out this formula and had proven that it worked if you and I work it, and had put it in this book for us, Bill heard about Roland and his what Dr. Jung had told him about the spiritual awakening, the spiritual experience being his only chance. And Bill wrote to Dr. Carl Jung in Zurich, Switzerland. And he asked him in the letter, how come he had known enough about alcoholism to so counsel Roland as he had done? And Dr. Jung wrote back, and he told Bill, in essence, that he had always known that the alcoholic's problem was his search for unity. His search for unity, and he couldn't find it. He even quoted one of my favorite verses. As the heart, H-A-R-T, as the heart panteth after the water brook, so panteth my soul after thee, O God. He'd always known that this was the alcoholic's problem. His attempt to find unity with the life around him and with the God that made him. And when he found the bottle, it seemed to be the missing ingredient. It seemed to let him live a little bit more comfortably with himself and in the society around him. And he had found chemical unity. And it did a pretty good job with him until it became the problem that only a spiritual answer could solve. Now, that's a beautiful thing. And most of us agree with it. Now, here's what happened. And this just curls my hair. This is fantastic. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing to me. Roland, having heard this, affiliated himself with the Oxford movement and got sober. And he ran into Ebbe. And he got Ebbe into the Oxford movement. And Ebbe got sober. And Ebbe called on Bill. And Bill got sober. And so the finger of God. Oh, this is so beautiful. In our entire history, the finger of God is so evident all the way through it. From Dr. Carl Jung to Roland to Ebbe to Bill, Bill to Dr. Bob, and Dr. Bob and Bill to us. What a beautiful thing it is. And how fortunate are we, I believe us to be, the most fortunate segment of humanity, of God's kids. Because, you see, we have to find an answer lest we die. You come here not looking for God, or to get our wives back, or to get the love of our kids back. Not even looking for health, in many cases, like my own. But just a way to live one day at a time, without drinking, so that we might rub out a little of the record. And we find that the formula for sobriety and the formula for the good life and the formula of God are all the same. And we find an answer that makes the chemical unnecessary. And it's an answer that don't stay in the meeting when we leave. It goes with us. And we're never alone anymore. How fortunate can a man be? God bless you. Thank you very much.
Has taken some notes made by Bill W. from Covina.
Good job with this deal. His two henchmen fell down on him. Not yet. In 1923, I was in the real estate business in Los Angeles. And I had a picture on my desk of an old man with a white beard down about to his navel. And the caption was, "I'm an old man, and I've had many troubles, most of which never happened." I like that real good. This, as we decided yesterday, is to be a question period. And Chuck Borden has the first question.
Chuck, I don't hesitate to ask this question for you. Look for the question. Happy in your position there. I've had a lot of people ask me, and been wondering whether or not you would consider next year doing the same thing for the group. And I know that you need a lot of lead time to come up these things up, and I've had a good time for many others. Enjoyed it so much, you got so much out of it. I want to consider doing it again. I'll make the arrangement. That's the question.
There's always one in every crowd. Decisions, decisions, decisions. I don't know, Chuck. We'll think about it. I don't know whether it'd be too quick to do it again next year or not. You got to change a little between them, you know. And I don't know whether we can grow very much in a year. We're not as green as we used to be. It's been 12 years since the last one. And I think this is just about right. 12 years. But I'll think about it. I think it's nice of somebody to think that they might want it. So I thank you for that. What's the next question?
Should we work with practicing alcoholics before we have taken all the steps ourselves?
I think
that the very moment that a guy decides he wants what we have and becomes willing to go to any length to get it, he is ready to work with alcoholics. Not that he tries to carry the message to alcoholics, but that he tries to carry the alcoholic to the message. As soon as we have decided that we want what's here, we could tell anybody, look, I found a place that seems to manufacture sobriety. A bunch of guys that are doing something about their drinking. And they have impressed me very much, and I'm going to meet. How about going with me? So you carry the alcoholic to the message. The bookie says, obviously we can't transmit something we don't have. That's what you're referring to. But you don't have to be anything but kind to carry a message. Really, that's all. Little love. Okay.
In our sobriety, how do we deal with emotions? A. Others we work with in the program. B. In our own.
Of sobriety. I got into that, I guess. I said sobriety was fourfold. Physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual. Emotional would just be one of the areas of our lives that has to become stable. For instance, if we're going to work with alcoholics, we can't afford to become emotionally involved in their program. Or in their problem, I mean. Not in their program, in their problem. We can't afford to become emotionally involved in the problem, or we lose all of our possibility for help. You gotta stay above the problem. Now, it seems like maybe that would be a sort of a cold attitude. It is not. You have to love more to stay emotionally involved, uninvolved in the problem, than you do to become involved in it. The answer is not in the problem. The answer is in the answer. I worked on my problem for 10 years. And the more I looked at the problem and the harder I worked on the problem, the greater the problem became. It was just like fertilizing, watering, and cultivating a weed. It grew out of all proportions. And I think we have to be able to live above the problem to be of value to those who have it. We don't get emotionally involved in the problem. It's not that we love less, it's that we love more. I think it takes much more love to release than it does to hold on to. Emotional stability comes, I am sure, out of this thing we call self-discovery. Physical sobriety comes from not drinking. We don't drink today. And after a while, we are physically free from the effects of alcohol. But until we become emotionally stable, mentally stable, and spiritually somewhat stable, we're not sober. So sobriety is the ability to live comfortably, peacefully, and joyously with oneself. I find much, much confusion in this area of becoming emotionally involved in the problems of our so-called babies. Many people think you've got to be emotionally involved in it. And I think we completely stymie ourselves when we do. That's the truth.
What about sex after sobriety?
Is there anybody here that wants to cover that thing? Do you want to speak on that? Next. Includes possession, but not the necessity to possess. I think that it's perfectly possible to live very happily in a marriage relation without emphasis on that particular deal. I know it's quite important. Many, many people. It's strange how important that it gets at times, and then in a little while how unimportant it is. We used to call it the biggest nut there is, you know. But I realize that this is a problem in many, many families. It might be in mine. I don't know. But I believe that sex as such should be just as spontaneous as everything else. I think it should come as the result of love. You know, the givingness of self to self in love. And I think that's the only way it has any value at all. I think that we as a sex are very, very lacking in this area. Actually, I do. All men. Because we are inclined to want what we want when we want it. And it's to explode. And that's what happens. And when the explosion's over, the job's done, as far as we're concerned. But I feel that that's a totally selfish approach. I think that the love and adoration both before and after the act is far, far superior than to the act itself. In other words, I find nothing wrong with sexual intercourse as a result of love, but as an objective, I think it's self-robbery again. It's a beautiful thing when it's the givingness of self to self in love. And otherwise, I find no value in it. That's all I could say.
What is the value of patience when counseling with another alcoholic?
If we had all the alcoholics in the world in this room right now, we would have 90% of the impatience of the human race. We are a very impatient lot. We want everything to happen yesterday. And patience is certainly a virtue. I doubt very much if our value as a counselor would equal our value as a listener. If you can get the guy talking, or the gal, if you can get them talking, this is the deal. In my own case, if I'm talking to somebody new, the one thing that I listen for is the first attempt at a belly laugh. This ain't no big deal. You can't get serious. An alcoholic cannot take a preachment or a lecture. We know all about the preachment and the lecture. We've given them to ourselves 1,000 times. We know exactly what they're going to say before they say it. And so, the sharing, and to get them to talk, and be a good listener, gives the counselor more value than talking himself. We're not experts on anything. And it's the simple little thing that opens the door. It isn't the profundity. Nobody ever got sober on profundity. Nobody. It's little things. Many of you heard me tell this, but I was talking at the Bob White group many years ago on Santa Barbara and Van Ness. And there was a drunk in bad shape sitting right about there where Mr. Castle is sitting. And came time for him to light a cigarette. And he couldn't do it. He couldn't get the things to mate. And he struggled. And after a while, a little old lady that was sitting next to him reached over and took his cigarette and his match and lit it and put it in his mouth. And the next year, I was there at the same time. And this guy got his birthday, first birthday. And I thought, well, I must have done pretty well, you know, in that talk. So I was prepared to get a nice compliment, you know, when he got up to take his birthday cake. And he said the reason he was back was not what was said or done in the meeting. It was the fact that this little old lady had lit a cigarette for him. This thing don't depend on profundity or expertise. It's love. And love is patient. Love is patient. Not everyone that I love to think about. This happened to La Habra group. I talk there on Friday before Christmas every year. And 10 or 12 years ago, there was a guy sitting along the wall. There were benches along the wall. And he was leaping. He wasn't shaking. He was leaping. And I went home and sat down beside him before the meeting started. And I put my arm around the guy. And I said, son, this ain't no big deal. If you don't drink, if you don't take that next drink, 3 days you'll be pretty nearly well, physically. Just put it off. Don't take that next drink. It ain't no big deal. Make a game out of it. And go for 3 days without a drink. See what happens to you. And for years, he's gone by me at least once a year in some meeting. And he gets right up to my left ear and he says, son, it ain't no big deal. And he goes on about his business. So, yes, if you love him, you're patient. Next.
How do we surrender and turn our will to God when after asking for guidance, we still flounder at times?
There are many times when even prayer is like braying up a chimney. No way can you seem to make any conscious contact with anything. Everything's futile. You have no purchase at all up there on the end of that line. And that's what the book means when it says, when everything else fails, get your wet drunk. Because, you see, when we're feeling futile, we want something. We want something, and it isn't happening. And there's no way that you can want something when you're working with a wet drug. No way. You can't think about yourself when you're working with a wet drug. That's one place where you give all your attention, interest, and love to the thing at hand. If it's just simply to outmaneuver it. To neither be the pukey or the puke-or in that case. So we got to get ourselves off our mind. Now I have a thing of my own. I can't solve a problem. No way I can solve a problem. And I haven't tried it much in these last 29 years because I've expected guidance and direction. But if I wake up to the fact that I'm all tied in a knot, working on something, and I'm just completely rigid almost, subconsciously, I've been messing with this thing and beating my brains out. And I recognize it. And this is my little deal, and it works for me right along. I
As I said to you, I share everything with my own God, good, bad, and indifferent. And in this case, I say, look, Dad, I'm beating the brains out over this problem, and I don't know the answer. You do. And when you get ready to give it to me, I'd certainly be glad to have it. Sure, thank you. And I'd dump it. And I never look at it again. I just dump it. That's it. And in a very short time, I find out that it either wasn't a problem in the first place, which is about 50% of the time, or I have the answer. It's the self-concern and the impatience that bring about this sort of an impasse in our own lives. And to get ourselves off our mind, there's nothing more highly recommended than to sit down with a wet drum. Does that do you any good?
With ego and self taking over periodically, do I analyze and look for answers to much?
You're a mess. If I were you, I'd just give up. I find so many of our people, even in the grapevine, I find so many of them writing about self-esteem, building self-esteem. I hear people get up here and talk all the time about you have to learn to love yourself before you can love anybody else. And I am most grateful that that ain't the case. I never spend any time trying to build up self-esteem. I never spend any time trying to love me. I wouldn't have taken me with a large dowry. I hated my damn guts. And so, I got busy doing the things this book suggests. And it wasn't trying to learn how to self-esteem me or to love me so I could love you. I don't think that is the way it is at all. Francis says, "For it is better to love than to be loved. It is better to understand than to be understood. For it is in giving that we receive. It is in forgiving that we are forgiven. And it is in dying to self that we awaken to eternal life." And that's exactly what we've been talking about ever since we've been down here. That's exactly what we've been talking about. I don't believe that an image fell. I don't believe that an image of me would add anything to my life at all. I haven't any more image of me than I have of a walrus. That isn't what I'm interested in. I'm not interested in an image of me. That's not why I'm here. I'm here to share me with anybody that wants me in love and let the chips fall where they may. I'm not even interested in your opinion of what's happened, except when you want to give it to me. That's not my deal. I love you. I love you, and that's all I have to do. That's what I'm interested in. That's my deal. It's not my deal who you love or what you love or what you think. That's your deal. I love you, period. I don't even have to concern myself about what you think of me. got no image at all of me. I think of myself exactly as that big window up there in front of my chair. That window, to me, is me. And when there's no obstruction, the light comes through. But the window is not the light. And I think of that drape as my ego. And when that drape's closed, the light don't come through. But just as the window is not the light, the drape is not the darkness. It just shuts out the light. So my business is keep the drape open, Phil, and let the light shine. And I don't furnish the light. I'm a channel. You and I are necessary to God as channels through which He goes forth into His creation. We're channels. Then we get ourselves out of the way and let it be. And let it be. Now, as we said last night, and as I say to me all the time, I'm either going to run my life and take the consequences thereof, or I'm not going to run it and take the consequences thereof. And I can't run mine. And I don't get involved in running my life. I get involved in living. I think losing yourself in life guarantees finding yourself in God. Guarantees it. Because all you got to do is to get rid of the roadblock. You lose yourself in life and find yourself in God. And Phil, if I were you, I wouldn't spend another 5 seconds trying to find self-worth or anything else. To find yourself, yes. To realize that whatever it is you're looking for is right here. What you're looking for, you're looking with. What you came here to get came with you. Everything you ever wanted to know, you've always known, and everything you've always wanted to be, you've always been. But it's covered up. Covered up. So we uncover and discover. And get lost in that feeling. Forget about you. To hell with you. And you got a little better break on that than I have. Maybe you have and maybe you ain't. Phil's got a little income. So it allows him to have a little more time on his hands than maybe he should have. You know? You hear yourself? I think that's it. Forget about old Phil and just do, and let the chips fall where they may. The beautiful thing about this deal is not to get serious about yourself. To make the whole deal a game. A play of life upon itself. And you have fun out of it. I have more fun with God than I do with you. I have a hell of a lot of fun with God. I think that the guy has a tremendous sense of humor. Or he wouldn't have hit himself in the last place we ever looked. You know. I think it's terrific. Very last place we ever looked. There he is. I can just see him, you know. Here I am trying to find a bottle. Off hours, you know, and I've got to have a drink. He says, look at that son of a bitch. He's hunting me and I'm with him. You see? Oh, I love it. It's a fun deal. You're too serious, Phil. Make a fun deal out of it, huh? That help any? Oh.
Should members of AA work professionally in the field of alcoholism?
Will some of you counselors answer that one? I do not really care much to comment on it, but I would say this. It's awfully hard. It's awfully hard for amateurs like us to get mixed up with professionals and stay amateurs. We're a strange bunch. All we have to do is to rub elbows a little while with a doctor and we become doctors. Maybe some people can retain their amateur standing in working for money in the field of alcoholism. I don't know. Maybe they can. But in my personal life, I've met only one that seemed to do it, and he wasn't around long enough to really see whether it was going to work out or not. And that was Warren Snyder. Warren died about a year or so after, 2 years after he started working in the field of alcoholism for money. Now, the one thing that would seem to be furthest from a paid 12-step call would be working with the National Committee on Alcoholism. Because the National Committee on Alcoholism has no recovery program at all. They are educational and referral. That's their business, and that's not the business we're in. So it would appear that there would be no conflict to work for the National Committee on Alcoholism. So they have no program of recovery. But those of my friends who work with them somehow become professionals. I'm mindful of one gal I love very, very much. And 10 years ago, she made one of the finest AA talks I ever heard in my life. And she became an employee, secretary of the Committee on Alcoholism. And she talked to our group a year ago, I guess. And she made just as fine a talk as she ever made. But it wasn't Alcoholics Anonymous talk. It was a professional talk. It was a professional talk. And the one thing about us that we must maintain is caring and sharing. We're not experts on anything. We share our experience, strength, and hope one with another in love. And so I haven't seen anybody even be able to do that kind of thing without seeming to get lost in professionalism. Incidentally, it wasn't 3 months after that talk that she was in the hospital herself. Not, I'm sure, for either pills or drinking. I say I'm sure. I'm not sure of anything. I'm like Phil. I don't know nothing. But she was in the hospital for a sort of a breakdown of some kind. I can't do it. Personally, when I talk
for organizations that have an honorarium. The thing I do carries an honorarium for, say, $75 to $150. I won't take it. I don't take it. Because whilst they don't know it, I'm getting them to do it. I learned what I'm telling them from you guys. From drunks who don't drink. And I can't any more take an honorarium than I can fly. Because you guys didn't charge me a thing. You didn't even ask me if I had anything. The only thing you said to me is, "Mister, were you looking for somebody?" And I said, "No, sir." And he said, "Well, what were you looking for?" And I said, "If it would interest you, sir, I was looking for sobriety." And you lit up like a Christmas tree. Took me and rocked me to sleep. Now I'm certain that any alcoholic is totally free to make a living. I think we're entitled to make a living. But if I were a preacher, excuse me, Dave, if I were a preacher, I would want my business on the side. Because I would not want to get up here and try to tell you monkeys what you want to hear. I would not want my gas and water in your hands. If you don't like me, you cut off my gas and water. So I've got to try to please you. I can't do that. I would want my business on the side. I'd want my money coming in from here. So I could tell you what I think. I can't talk without saying it as I feel it, as I think that it should be. And I can't work in that field. But if I were a captain in the Marines and they wanted me to head up the program of alcoholism for the Marines, and I could set up my own staff, as certain Marines have had the privilege of doing, I might do what a captain in the Marines who asked that question did. He turned to me and he says, "What am I going to do?" I said, "Get your staff to handle the related disorders. Get all these people that you have working with you to handle the hop heads, the pill heads, the sex maniacs," like, who was that then? "And you deal in Alcoholics Anonymous, the drunk and Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what you did. And it's worked out beautifully, and I don't see it's doing you any harm." "Yes, Dave, what?"
"Should members of AA attend meetings of Al-Anon? Are we missing anything?